Martin Croxall is a journalist and one of the main news presenters on BBC Television News. And I'm going to embarrass her, she doesn't know this yet, by quoting from something written by CBS Network news correspondent David Henderson. And he was talking about Martin's handling of the Paris attacks in 2015. And I'll just read a little bit of it. Despite the unspeakable carnage and utter chaos across central Paris, a no-nonsense BBC World News presenter brought level-headed clarity to the attacks and horror in Paris with an understated professional style that was a reflection, I believe, of television's great news anchors like Walter Cronkite, Peter Jennings and Dan Rather. Her name is Martine Croxall. Now, she knows where that comes from.
I do know where it came from, yes. Yeah, and it was extremely flattering.
It's a lovely piece.
It's lovely. I know.
It's great.
Oh, gosh, to be compared to Peter Jennings and Walter Cronkite. Yeah. I know. Well, Peter Jennings was my favourite from ABC News, who died not so long ago. Yeah. No, it was a lovely thing to write. He wrote to me, actually, on the night and said, I've been watching you. And he started asking me questions like, when are you normally on? And I was thinking, why is that? And then he sent me a link, and I thought, good grief. Go.
Martine, you started, I'm not talking about starting life, although I know that was in Leicestershire.
It was.
Presumably you were educated there as well.
I was educated partly in Leicestershire and also over the border in Warwickshire.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then you went off to university in Leeds.
I did.
To study geography, which is, it's a sort of great indeterminate title. What does geography mean?
It is. Yeah, well, it means, depends which kind of course you're doing. But I'm going to champion geography for just one
absolutely,
minute, Rob, if you don't
mind.
Because
you are a member of the Institute.
I'm a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society, and I'm very fortunate to host events for them sometimes at their headquarters, which is just on Kensington Gore near Imperial College in London. Geographers have the best employment rate after graduation of all degrees. So, because it's recognised as being a very good analytical degree, a bit like history. History comes up for a close second. But yeah, geography is in demand from employers. I use mine all the time and it informs the interviews that I do, I think, sort of spatially and geographically.
Right. So it doesn't matter that you could say, well, actually, it's not conditioning you to go into any particular route. You could go anywhere from geography.
Yes, and people did. I mean, the people I was at university with went into all sorts of things. Accountancy, production management, environment agency, which is obviously an obvious one. But it's a massive subject that different degree courses in different universities will cover in very different ways.
So why did you go into communication?
It's a very good question. I wanted to be a vet until I was about 15. I think I'd watched too much All Creatures Great and Small. But then I realised that I probably could have done the right A-levels, but it would have been a stretch for me. And the things that I really enjoyed doing were the humanities. And I actually liked producing things, making things, creative, not necessarily in a, you know, I'd like to paint pictures sort of way, although I do that, as it turns out, but not well enough to make a living from. I like projects. I like creating things. And I just thought, well, how could I do that? And I thought, well, writing, journalism, radio. And I just decided that that's the way I was going to try. And I was very fortunate.
Had you done any of that at school or university?
I'd written a bit for the student newspaper at Leeds, but it wasn't print journalism that I particularly wanted to do. I liked the idea of making radio programmes. And my idea was that I wanted to be a magazine programme producer, and I very much wanted to be behind the scenes. I was kind of confident on a one-to-one basis, but in my teens, I was the girl who would blush crimson if you asked me anything. And so a lot of my contemporaries from school are very surprised that I now am reading the news on national television, but I'm no longer 14 years of age and I've got a bit more confidence. But I didn't intend to be on air at all. And it was only one day when I had rung Radio Leicester, which was my local radio station in the Midlands, close to where my parents live. And I just said, look, I've just come back from travelling abroad. I'd like to come and see what you do. I'd like to consider a career in radio. Fortunately, the station manager said, yeah, come in. And I walked into the newsroom. It seemed like bedlam to me, people running around with tape recorders, filing things for the news. And I just thought, how does everybody know what they're doing? But they all seem to. And there was a real buzz in there. And it was immensely exciting. And I was put with a magazine programme. It was partly a phone-in programme. And I literally started making the tea, answering the phones, showing guests in and out, bits of filing. It was the most basic beginning you could have had. And as a result of that, I understood where I fitted in to the greater scheme of things in the BBC. And it was a very good place to start. And there were lots of opportunities because budgets are always tight in local radio. So you get a chance to do things quite quickly. If you've got an idea, they want to get it on air. And one day, the producer of the programme I was working on said, you've got to go out and do an interview. live. And I said, I don't want to do that. I didn't come here to be on air. Well, there's no one else to do it, so you'll have to be you. And they sent me down to the centre of Leicester, and if anybody knows the city, there's a clock tower, which is a bit of a sort of a location where everybody knows it, a meeting point for people. And I'd got to interview two people about the launch of a charity fundraising effort to build the National Forest, plant the National Forest in Leicestershire, Staffordshire and Derbyshire. One of the people was dressed as a tree in a rubber costume, which was quite a challenge because it's difficult to hear him. But I did it, and I seemed to have a bit of a knack for just talking and describing and being the eyes of the listener, being conversational. And it just took off from there. And then they trained me to use the radio car. My career was a little bit back to front. Most people start doing recorded pieces rather than live. And I did it the other way around. And I spent 6 months travelling around Leicestershire and Rutland doing live reporting, which was the best grounding because you're having to think on your feet. You're making programmes on a shoestring.
Were you still on the work experience, or was this, are you now being paid by them to
do this? I got paid for some clerical work that I did. That was the first bit of, I think I worked for 6 weeks without earning any money. I'm very understanding parents. And then Radio Leicester seemed to think I'd got some ability. So they sent me on training courses to London. And slowly I built up a set of skills that were actually useful to the station. So they would pay me for making packages and doing interviews, going out gathering material. And I think I used to earn about £15 a day to begin with. And then we had a pay rise. And it was £25 a day, which felt like you'd won, you know, the lottery. But this was before the National Lottery even existed. But then I got a contract and then a staff job. And I followed a path through the BBC, which is quite well set out for you to sort of navigate. We have this system called attachments, where you're seconded. You apply for it as if it's a job, and then you go for 3 months, 6 months, 12 months to a new department. You learn new skills, and then you go back to your home post, assuming they haven't got a job to give you. And so it's a way of working your way around the BBC quite safely.
So it's an employer which actually looks after its staff, sees the opportunities and wants people to find their own opportunities. Is that the way it works?
Yes, and there are a lot of people I work with at New Broadcasting House, sort of the main London office of the BBC, who started in local radio and followed various paths. The obvious one is the one I did, which was to go to regional television and then to national television or to national radio. So it's very well trodden.
Where did you go from Leicester?
I went to Nottingham. To work for East Midlands Today, where I did one of these attachments to learn about TV, because it's so different from radio. I'd got used to thinking in sound and then found it very difficult to think in pictures, because if you can't show it, you can't really say it. You know, you need to write to your pictures. So I found that quite a gear change. But then I got myself together a little showreel of all the things that I'd done while I was there for about 4 months. And that got me my next job, which is why I came to live in Hertfordshire. Because I went to work at BBC Elstree as a broadcast journalist. So you were doing a bit of everything.
What was it, BBC Elstree?
That was Newsroom South East, which is now BBC London. So that was in 1997. And I had three very busy years there reporting on London and the South East. And I didn't really know the patch particularly well at the beginning, but I certainly did by the end.
So you moved out of radio now and you were fully in television?
Yes, did bits of radio, because we used to have this sort of bi-media system where you would contribute to radio as well. But I was very fortunate that I got there, and I'd only been there about a week or 10 days. I think it was my seventh or eighth shift. And I had a phone call one night from a colleague. She said, "You're on in the morning." I said, "Yes, I know. I'm producing the breakfast TV bulletin." She went, "No, you're reading them." And I said, "Are you sure?" She said, "Yes, someone's gone sick. You did a screen test. They were happy with it. You're on." Well, I was terrified, you know. And I know people who watched my first bulletin go out and they still remind me of how startled I looked. But, you know, I did it. I talked to time. I didn't disgrace myself or let anybody down. So they let me carry on.
And now you are well and truly established in BBC Television News. But you've in fact covered, I mean, there's what the main sort of BBC One News, but then there's the BBC World News. And it's a bit confusing sometimes to work out, because I keep switching between channels with the news, because there's a lot of things going on.
Yes, well, you can't watch BBC World News in this country, but I did work for that channel for about 10 years, which was a fantastic experience, because the international news agenda and the way you do interviews and it is very different from the domestic one. But I work for the BBC News channel, which for a long time was called BBC News 24. Then at times of the day, 1 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 10 o'clock, the big national network bulletins appear on our channel as well as on BBC One. And so you'd see the same thing. The two channels come together at various times of day for those big built bulletins. But the channel I work for is on air 24 hours a day in some form or another.
And how many hours are you on call at a time? Is it
my shift?
It's not 24 hours, obviously.
No, thankfully they do have a few other people to rely upon. My usual time slot is evenings towards the end of the week and over the weekend. So I go on air at either 6:30 or 7 o'clock, and I'm on air until just before midnight. We do have some breaks where sport take over, or there's a pre-recorded programme, or we hand to the 10 o'clock news, or BBC World might do some of the output for us. But I can be on air for 5 hours. If a big story breaks, as it did when the London riots happened quite a few years ago now, I was on air for 5.5 hours solidly. And on the night of the Paris attacks, which happened in November 2015, I was on air for about 3 hours, 2.5, 3 hours, as we started to understand what had happened in Paris and the enormity of it.
Now, you're sitting at a desk in front of a number of cameras. Mm-hmm. What do you know about what's going on in the world? Are you getting it all through screens that are in front of you that are telling you what's happening?
So in my desk, set into the desk, I've got a computer which is telling me the running order. What are the stories we're doing in the order that we're doing them? That goes out of the window when there's a big story happening. So everything you've produced and you think you're going to do, you're not doing. So in some ways, although people feel that breaking news is very difficult, in some ways it's the most basic form of journalism. It's the who, what, when, where, why, how questions. You're trying to get to the bottom of what's really going on. And there's a lot of repetition. Also in my desk, there's a big screen split into nine. And they're the OSs, the outside sources. So they can be camera points from all over the world or feeds of pictures that are coming in from anywhere. And they're very useful to me because if I know that we're waiting for the French president to make an announcement live from the Élysée Palace, I can be watching that empty podium. And then when Emmanuel Macron or François Hollande, as it was during the Paris attacks, arrives on the podium, I'm ready to go to hand to Paris to hear what he's got to say. So those screens are very, very useful. They give you sort of forewarning of what's coming in. They can also be live pictures of a security operation that might be underway, as there were several, of course, that night in Paris. So they're very useful to me. But I also get information fed to me in print form. Messages get sent to me a bit like an email. Sometimes social media can be useful, but also be very unhelpful because you need to make sure that you're using verified sources. You don't want to be quoting from some unverified source because that's the way to get into trouble. So we're very circumspect about nailing things down as fact until we've had it verified by a BBC reporter, producer or correspondent.
You get to the studio at a certain time. I don't know what time you get there. If you're on at 6:30, are you there several hours before you so you know what's going on? Or do you prepare for the next hour? How do you get ready for what? Or is there a producer somewhere who's doing it all for you?
TV presenters should never forget that there's a huge team of people behind them, technical people and production people, editorial people, who are giving you what you need to hopefully do a good job. You're the gatekeeper. And anyone who forgets that is heading for a bit of a fall. I'm acutely aware that I work with extremely talented, dedicated and hardworking people. And I hopefully don't mess up all the work that they've done in preparation. So what I tend to do is get into work an hour and a half to 2 hours before I'm due on air. That's a sort of standard amount of time that you need to read in. So you're already, of course, keeping across the news. You're listening to the radio in the course of the day. Maybe you've put the telly on in the course of the day. You're catching up on things from websites, newspapers, social media. You're constantly sort of plugged in and keeping abreast of what's happening. The first person I talk to when I come in is the assistant editor, who's the person who is in charge of shaping the output in the time that we're on air. And I will, the main things that I'm interested in are what's going to be live. So what are the stories that we're likely to be doing live interviews on? Who are we talking to? What's their view likely to be? And what's the latest on that particular story? So I will read around that and formulate my own questions. Often we'll have producers who provide you with a guest brief, which is this is who we're talking to, this is why, and this is what their main views are. And then I try to formulate my own questions because if I can't do that, I don't know why I'm sitting in the chair, really. The other live events that I need to know about are things like, is President Trump going to make a speech from the Rose Garden? An announcement. is he going to sign a, you know, presidential executive order? And if so, why? So then I would need to be able to talk around that subject, explaining the context, explaining the background and the significance. So they're the things that I will be preparing for before I go on air. And then I tend to go to makeup 45 minutes or an hour before I'm due on air. It takes about 40, 45 minutes to be made camera ready. They're the miracle workers of the BBC. And you then back upstairs, having hopefully read into all the subjects you're going to be covering while you're in the makeup chair quite often. And then you get into the studio, you put your kit on. So underneath my clothes, in what you can't see, is a big, thick elastic belt with pockets in it, which hold a radio talkback pack and a radio microphone pack, which are hopefully hidden underneath my clothes. And I've got an earpiece in so I can hear what's being said to me from the gallery. And then you're on air and you turn up 10 minutes before you go on air, and then you're on air on the top of the hour usually, yeah.
Some of what you do is literally the news. Others is where you're interviewing people in the studio. And you're,
yes, or down the line, as we call them. Yes, yeah, details down the line. Yeah.
I was thinking for the moment of what the papers say. We might have a couple of journalists or other experts talking about what's in the papers that day. And you're having to wing that a bit, aren't you?
That's not scripted. Other than we do a quick rundown of what's on the front pages of the newspapers, which we call the stack. And that's where we flip through the graphicised front pages. And they're not actually there. It's called augmented reality graphics. And I turn to look at them, but they're not there. And then they appear on television thanks to the graphic system that we have. But then I have, as you say, two guests, usually journalists, because they have to be able to talk about any subject under the sun. And they've usually come in an hour or so before we go on air at 10:30 and 11:30 to have a look through the papers, to choose the stories. And usually I have read the front pages, but often it's a rather cursory glance. And so it's my job to steer them through the six or seven pages that we've got and that we've chosen.
And there's a time limit?
Yes.
You know how long?
12 to 15 minutes. Sometimes if we're lucky, we'll do a longer version. So particularly around the Brexit story, sometimes there are some momentous days that require longer for you to sort of pore over the papers. But that's great fun, because for me, the unscripted output, you don't know where it's going to go. It's also the end of the day. It's you're looking ahead to what the papers are going to be reporting on the next morning. And you've got a bit of leg room to have some fun with it, because it is most news, isn't it? It's pretty grim. And it's just nice to have a bit of levity. Somebody asked me, I did an interview, an event a few months back at St Albans Boys School, where it was the politics students, and they asked me a lot of questions. And the one question that I'd never been asked before was, what's the most important thing to get right? And I don't think I've ever been asked that before. And for me, it's tone. Because if your tone's wrong and you sound flippant, or you're making in-jokes that exclude the viewer, that doesn't go down well, quite understandably. And I just think tone is the most important thing. So although we have a bit of fun on the papers, and I hope it comes across that I enjoy my job, because I certainly do, and I think it's a huge privilege to do it, as long as you get your tone right, in the right places, you can have a bit of fun with it.
It's said with radio that you need to think that you're talking to a person.
That's what I was told.
Is that what you do on television?
Yes, I do. Alistair Stewart on ITV News was asked on social media recently, well, we were both asked, who do you think of when you broadcast? And Alistair said, a family of four, which is very Alistair. And I said, an intelligent acquaintance. So it's someone who you know a little bit, but you're not overly familiar like your best friend. And it's someone who is smart, is switched on, is interested in the news. In some cases, will know more than you do about subjects. And so that helps me, I hope, pitch things at the right level.
You have to be aware of a lot of different things. You don't have to have in-depth knowledge of a lot of different things, other than, I guess, at the moment, politics, because politics is so dominant. But do you read a lot? Do you think, do you have time to read around? I mean, you read 12 papers a day?
No, well, I read bits and pieces of lots of different things. And I remember a long time ago when I worked in local radio, we were told there was no right paper to read, there's no wrong paper to read. Your listeners will be reading a range of different newspapers, so it's a good idea to read a range of different views. And a lot of the stuff that I read now is online. I've subscribed to online newspapers, and I read a lot of long reads that I would never have come across before, because social media takes you to those places. And I find that has sort of broadened my reading in some ways. And I know it's difficult for newspapers because they're competing with all of that, and they're trying to find a model whereby they can be online and still make a profit. I just also make myself follow people on social media who I don't agree with. Or otherwise, you create this little bubble, an echo chamber for yourself. And it's really good to be challenged all the time.
It's like if you only read The Guardian or you only read the Mail, you're getting two completely different worldviews.
Yes, and people tend to read the newspaper that supports their view in the first place. And of course, as you know, I'm not allowed to express an opinion on the BBC, and I hope that I don't. And it also, doing this job, it does make you see the different sides. It's like, well, I can see on the one hand, but I can see on the other. And so you almost find it difficult to express an opinion sometimes in the end because you get so used to not doing so.
You obviously enjoy what you do. What's the best type of television that you do? Do you want to do other things?
Well, yeah, I'd whatever they'd like to offer me, really. But I recently, which was a total departure for me, I was on the red carpet at the BAFTAs at the Royal Albert Hall. And I hadn't done that before. And it was supposed to be an hour and a quarter of live broadcasting. And again, we had no script. We had no real structure because you don't know who's coming down the red carpet. I have two guests, Jason Solomons, a film critic who could talk about every film that was nominated, and Maria Grashvogel, who is a fashion designer, and she was able to talk about all of the wonderful gowns that the women in particular were wearing, although there were quite a few men who veered away from the usual, you know, black tie this year. And in the end, we were on air for an extra half an hour because we were waiting for the royals to arrive, William and Kate, and they were running late. So it meant we stayed on air. And we did an hour and three quarters, unscripted, no auto cue. And it was wonderful. You fling yourself on air. You kind of know where you're going and you're making it up as you go along. And Lizo Mazimba, who is our entertainment correspondent, was on the red carpet. We were handing to him when he was, you know, talking to Olivia Colman or Bill Nighy or whoever. And he spoke to a lot of the really big name stars. And we made, apparently, what was a very nice programme. And I'd never done it before and I loved it. So live TV takes a lot of beating. And for me, it feels like a very safe space. I suppose because I've been doing it such a long time. It's almost like my living room now, the studio I'm in. And that's how I think and hope we're able to be quite sort of relaxed and conversational about it, given the fact you are constrained by the grammar of TV news.
Mm-hmm. You're not tempted to go and make documentaries? You've got the production experience, you've got the writing, you've got a fairly good skill set.
Yes, I've made rates a few a long, long time ago, made a few radio documentaries. I think the problem with doing live news is you love the immediacy and the urgency of it. And so documentaries which take quite a long time to make, I'm not sure I've got the patience. It's a very different approach to have. But yeah, I've got some ideas of things that I'd like to make. But it's just a case of finding the right commissioning editor because the commissioning process can be a bit of a mystery.
When I was young, newsreaders were all men.
And they sounded very different from me because I am conscious that I do have a regional accent and to a lot of people in Hertfordshire, I will sound very northern probably.
I wouldn't think so. I was thinking of the various comments made that, you know, when we moved on from the men who used to sit there in their dinner jackets, as it were, reading the news. Mm. There are a lot more women in now than there were before, aren't there?
People
like me don't even notice whether you're looking at them, as it were.
No, I'm glad about that because I think you've really got somewhere when you stop noticing that somebody is different as
even
they would have
been though the viewer is aware that the man can turn up in a suit and the woman has to think what she dresses in.
Yes, I think it was a newsreader in New Zealand who deliberately wore the same suit for a whole year and nobody noticed, whereas of course if I wore the same dress 2 days on the trot, somebody would notice. Yeah, it is a peculiar thing because the question I get asked most often is, do they do your hair and makeup? When I'd rather be asked about how do you approach an interview, but it's a consideration. TV is a visual medium. You need to look the part. Nothing about you needs to stand out. You know, you don't want your hair sticking up on end. Your jewellery needs to be sort of symmetrical. You don't want dangly earrings that are distracting. So it's about looking professional without there being anything that stands out too much.
But also maintaining that relationship with the viewer, which is what you talked about earlier, where you're thinking, you're talking to somebody.
Yeah, that was one of the first things I was ever taught when I went into broadcasting is that you don't listen as a group. You listen and watch as an individual. And that comes down to things like, I was taught, don't say, hello, everyone. Just say hello. And also don't say things like, oh, you've written into us. Well, no, I haven't. Viewers have written into, they've texted us or whatever. So I'm quite careful about, maybe I'm a bit old-fashioned, I don't know, because some of these conventions seem to fall by the wayside a bit. But I like to be talked to as an individual, and that's where those the best broadcasters get it right for me. And so that's what I'm aiming for, really. But the BBC has got a project called 50-50, and we're trying to make sure that we've got a 50% split between male and female contributors. We're getting there. Mm. You know, it's a cultural change, and it's just reminding yourself as a producer to think differently, to try and invite different voices onto the output.
Women are going into aspects of broadcasting where they wouldn't go before. I mean, I'm thinking of the foreign correspondents that go into war zones and face as much danger as any reporter has ever
faced.
Yeah,
why shouldn't they? Yeah. I mean, there's a long history of women as war correspondents. Martha Gellhorn, of course, who was married to Ernest Hemingway, is the one that immediately springs to mind. But some of our finest correspondents, I'm thinking of Lise Doucette or Le Guerin, they go everywhere and face the same dangers that their male colleagues would face.
And the fact that we have changed significantly, we've still got a way to go. You say the 50-50 is a project, you haven't got there yet. That will go on. What's the next thing for television news? How far the social media are not undermining it, but presenting challenges to the news all the time, because you're trying to present not fake news, but real news.
Yes.
And you're surrounded by potentially fake news coming in from other sources. And we're trying to pick our way through all this. Where are we going next?
Well, we have a team called Reality Check who will get hold of a subject around which there is confusion, or there is disinformation, or there's received wisdom, and you go to town and you do a proper journalist job, and you pick up the phone and you speak to experts, or you get facts verified. And Reality Check is just proper journalism, checking that you've got the right version of events. And of course, that doesn't mean that opinions around that subject won't differ. Of course they will. And we need to try and reflect, not extreme views, but we need to try and reflect a broad church.
We're in difficult times because a lot of people are obsessed with conspiracies. Everything is a conspiracy. Everybody's always attacked the BBC. The left attacks BBC for being right-wing. The right-wing attacks BBC for being left-wing. So you must be doing something right in the middle.
Let's hope so.
It's probably true that those who are looking for a certain, as you mentioned with newspapers, those who are looking for a certain sort of truth will not necessarily look at television news. They'll go to certain social media which fulfil their wishes and fantasies.
Yeah, and the BBC is very aware that habits are changing and people have a choice about how and where they get their news from. And it is a challenge. And we are seeing a bit of an erosion in viewing figures, but we still have respectable viewing figures. And this is where the BBC recognises that if it wants to attract a broad range of audience, we have to have a broad range of output and programmes that will appeal to everybody. And you can't please everyone all the time, but we're going to try.
Just going back right to the beginning, you took a traditional route through from what was traditional, I don't know if it still is, which is local radio station, getting work experience, then going into local television, then into the national television and global television and so on. Is that still available? Is that route still available?
Yes, it is. A lot of people tend to do an undergraduate degree, and I think the best newsrooms are populated by people with degrees in all sorts of different subjects. So you've got experts in economics and politics and history and the arts, even, you know, the sciences. Science journalism is very difficult to do well. A lot of people then go on and do a postgraduate diploma, which is a one-year course usually, which teaches you the skills of broadcasting, editing and interviewing. And then the BBC runs highly, highly contested, very competitive training courses. It also, in the last few years, has started to introduce digital journalism apprenticeships to try to attract people who haven't necessarily been to university. I went and talked to a group of them at the BBC's training centre at Wood Norton in the Vale of Evesham a couple of years ago, and they were all in their late teens, early 20s, none had been to university, and they were from very diverse backgrounds. One had been working in a chip shop, one had been working in a garden centre, another one had been unemployed. But these were young people who had really brilliant storytelling skills in digital form. So they were bloggers and vloggers, and they could write really well for the website. They were also taught radio and television as well, so that they understood how all the different types of journalism within the BBC fit together. And that's proved to be very popular because we're trying to reach people who don't think necessarily that the BBC is the kind of place where they would work if they feel that they don't see and hear people who are like them on radio and television. And it's trying to change that.
Martin, we've, as they don't say in television news, run out of time.
Well, you're not meant to say that.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.